Aloha, and welcome to Let's Talk Story, the value of architecture in Hawaii. My name is Jason Takeuchi. I'm a project architect at Ferraro Choi & Associates, and will be your host today. Let's Talk Story is a new podcast series geared towards engaging emerging professionals in documenting the history, life lessons, and perspectives of some of Hawaii's most established architects. Today's episode is written and produced by AIA Honolulu and its Emerging Professionals Committee, and is made possible through the AIA National College of Fellows Component Grant Program and generous volunteer contributions. A special shout out to the Moana Surfrider Hotel and Marriott for hosting us today. We are excited to talk with Dr. Carol Sakata, FAIA, one of the most important and influential architects in Hawaii. Carol is the president of CDS International, where she has practiced since joining in 1972 with projects in Hawaii, the Pacific Basin, and the Far East. Throughout her career, Carol has developed a passion for practice areas such as project delivery, education, licensure, and practice regulation. Although she has a substantial portfolio of built work, Carol has made an even larger impact on the profession beyond the constructed environment through the development of practice-based tools, processes, through mentorship, and through service to others. In the AIA, Carol served as the 63rd and first female president of the Hawaii Society AIA in 1989 and was instrumental in planning the 1982 AIA National Convention, which was the only time the convention was ever held here in Honolulu. She was elevated to AIA Fellowship in 1993. In the community, Carol has served as an adjunct associate professor at the University of Hawaii at Manoa School of Architecture, teaching professional practice and ethics, and also served as a key advisor to the Doctor of Architecture program. And most recently, Carol has been selected as the recipient of the 2023 AIA Hawaii Medal of Honor in partnership with the Hawaii Architectural Foundation. This is the highest individual honor bestowed on any architect by AIA Hawaii. It's an honor to welcome Dr. Carol Sakata, FAIA, to Let's Talk Story. Carol, how are you?
Good. Thank you very much, Jason. We've had a nice time this morning and into the afternoon touring around the Moana Hotel, which was a project that I invested a lot of time in at the time we were doing it, and it's quite a spectacular property in Honolulu now and Waikiki for over 120 years. So
absolutely,
it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, so, I mean, we're actually sitting here in the Surfrider, Moana Surfrider Hotel. We're in the Eva Wing. We just walked through the hallways, through the courtyards, through the under the banyan tree, the veranda. I mean, there's so much I learned from you today. There really is a special feeling at this place, isn't there?
Yeah, it's really a one-of-a-kind property because it's the first resort hotel in Hawaii, actually, built in 1901. And so as you can imagine, if you've ever seen historic photos of Honolulu and Waikiki, there was not much along this stretch of beach at that time,
yeah,
except for some private residences of Ali'i and some very well-heeled
and we saw some of those photos.
Yeah. It's was spectacular when it was built. It's after all the years and ups and downs it had, and since the historic rehabilitation, it's still a spectacular place. And you can imagine that when Waikiki was, behind here was maybe rice paddies, duck ponds, things like that, that this was quite the place and the center of elegant living for sure if you didn't have access to Iolani Palace. And at the invitation of the monarchs, they were, of course, a little earlier because the monarchy had been overthrown by the time this hotel was built. But for sure, it was a destination, from the time it opened.
Yep, and you can feel all the history in this place. I mean, we looked at some of the photos displayed on the walls. There's just so much memorabilia. And you can tell that this building has been through so much change over the years. We walked through the porte cochere, how that's changed from the awning type to what it is now, the growth of the banyan tree. And one of the reasons why we are here today is because you had an extremely important role in the renovation of the hotel to what it is today. Talk to us about what your role was and what that experience was like.
Happy to do that. In about 1985 or 86, I was approached by a local architect and preservation architect, Virginia Murison, who I'd worked with on some other projects before then. And it was looking like this project might be kind of getting off the ground. So she was essentially a one-person firm. She had one staff member who worked with her. And so she obviously needed a lot of support to execute, you know, a major renovation like this. She had originally become involved with the property to put new carpeting in the lobby. So this whole project grew from lobby carpet replacement to a full-on historic rehabilitation of a six-story hotel. Mm-hmm. And it had a lot of challenges, but basically my firm and me, we were, you know, the support system for Virginia, because she was the designer, she was the interior designer, she was the historic architect. She had the vision for the whole thing, but she didn't have the capability, given the small nature of her firm, to execute a project of this size. So we joined forces. We were got the go-ahead for the job. We were told it was awarded to us on April Fool's Day, 1986.
You're like, is this real?
Yes. And, oh, by the way, we want to have documents ready for bidding by September.
Oh, man.
And there were no existing drawings of the hotel. So everything was done by looking at historic photographs, measuring things, taking new photos. We did lots of field measuring. And since it was an operating hotel, they wouldn't let us open up any construction and look to see what was behind it. So a lot of time during construction was spent trying to figure out how to solve problems that we didn't even know existed. So it was quite the undertaking. And by 1989, it had actually successfully gotten finished. There was lots of challenges you've got to deal with. Structural integrity, updating life safety systems, modern things like air conditioning, trying to improve the energy efficiency, accessibility problems, because this hotel basically was not accessible at all. Everything was stairs everywhere. So we put in some, you know, rather, you know, ramps that are kind of hidden. You can't really, they look like they've always been there, but they haven't been. They're not obtrusive. They blend right in. But, and this was actually, you know, about 5 years before the Americans with Disabilities Act was even, you know, enacted. So we were kind of forging ahead.
You're ahead of the curve.
Yeah, but in the end, it was a very satisfying project. It's held up well.
Yeah, it has.
It won 13 national and international and local awards from various organizations.
Well deserved.
So that was our reward in the end, you know, for all that we went through.
I mean, you're starting
during
from
the 3 years.
Starting from a carpet kind of replacement project all the way up to a full renovation.
Yeah, it's turned in, essentially the construction cost was a little less, but at the time it was billed as like a $35 million project, but that's like in 1980s dollars, you know, so it would be way, way, way more than
like
that today.
That's amazing. Well, speaking of history, we're also here to learn a lot about you as a person, as an architect. I do want to start by learning more about your roots. So we've known each other for a number of years. I know that becoming interested in architecture often starts at a very early age. So let's talk about your upbringing in Washington State. How was it like growing up there?
It was very nice. I lived in Seattle, grew up there. I wasn't born there, but my family is from that area. I was born in Pittsburgh when my dad was in graduate school at University of Pittsburgh. So I'm the outlier. I'm born in Pennsylvania. And my sisters and both my parents are born in Western Washington, and one of my grandparents. So definitely, you know, that was our home base. And mm-hmm. even though Seattle has its awful reputation for rainy weather, it's a really beautiful setting with the hills, the salt water, the lakes, the mountains. And so when I was a kid, we almost every weekend in the summer, we would go camping somewhere in Washington State, often in Western Washington, but sometimes in Eastern Washington. Go to the mountains, the national forests, mm-hmm. you know, really get out. My dad liked photography and hiking, and so we were always out somewhere, you know, cooking on a propane stove and, you know, the whole works.
Yeah, I can hear that.
In a tent. The first tent didn't even have a floor in the bottom of it, you know. But we had a lot of camping trips, so, you know, enjoying the scenic beauty, you know, of that the Pacific Northwest has mm-hmm. to offer, mm-hmm. you know, it's really ingrained in me. And that's actually one similarity I see in Hawaii is, even though the climate's yes. totally different, you have the water, you have the mountains, things are green. So in that way, you know, it feels very familiar.
Yep.
But on these camping trips, my mother's mother, my grandmother, would go with us actually most of the time. And she would sit in the back seat between my sister and I, and she'd dole out candy and keep us entertained. And she was actually a trained artist. She attended Portland Art School. And then, so she always had, you know, the brownie box cameras, and she always had sketch paper and pencils and stuff like that. So she always kept my sister and I busy, you know, being entertained by drawing, sketching, taking photos.
Yeah.
And so it was good background for, you know, all of the visual aspects of
absolutely
things.
Mm-hmm. And I did learn from you that your grandmother was a draftsperson in the Navy.
Yes.
On top of that, you had exposure to an AI fellow who did a home renovation. And I can't help but think those experiences must have had some impact on the trajectory of your career path. Mm-hmm.
Well, in my grandmother's case, actually, she was very interesting because she enlisted in the Navy within 2 weeks of when they first allowed women to join.
Wow.
In about 1917, I think. So with her art background, I don't know how much she knew technical drawing at that point, but she was assigned to the Naval Architect's Office at Bremerton Shipyard as a draftsman. So I still have her scales.
Oh, do you?
Architectural and engineering scales.
That's so cool.
I use them every day. They're on my desk. I have her drafting set, you know, compass and, you know, all that kind of stuff. They're kind of ornate looking, actually, but very beautiful. Of course, we don't tend to use those kinds of tools these days, but I used them when I was in college. So, and she would get one of the things she did for a living when she was an adult was before the days when color photography was really prevalent, especially large format. She would get commissions from companies who wanted to have photo murals hand colored of, like, you know, aerials of their manufacturing plant, or
really?
In the case of Northwest Bell Telephone Company, she did a series of, you know, landscapes and scenic views, you know, around Washington State.
Oh, that's awesome. You still and have those today?
We have some of them, yes. And actually, my sister and I would help her, so to speak. Because she would have these, you know, this one I remember was some kind of a factory from the air. and it had a whole big parking lot just all full of cars. And so my grandmother did all this stuff in watercolor, actually. I mean, oil paint with brushes. There's other techniques where people kind of use a Q-tip and smear paint on the photo, but she didn't do that. Everything was hand painted. So she would put my sister and I to work hand painting color on the cars in the parking lot.
Wow. Wow.
So that was our contribution to her painting commissions. But so it, just a lot of kind of, you know, visual things. And then when I was about 11, I think, my parents decided to do a fairly major, you know, addition to the house and some remodeling to it. And the architect they hired was an AIA fellow from Seattle. And so I would, you know, go along to meetings at his office and when he came over. And I remember one of the first things he said, because my mother was explaining what she wanted to have done, and the first thing he did was walk back into the living room and he says, "I think we need to relocate the front door." That was not on my mother's agenda at all. And in the end, they didn't relocate the front door. But he thought things would flow better, excuse me, if the door was, you know, moved to the side. But and then later on, he designed a new building for the church we belonged to. So went to other, you know, meetings and stuff.
Yeah, so you ran into each other.
With him, yeah.
That's awesome. I learned from you also that you became interested in drafting in high school, and you enrolled in a drafting class as the only female in that class. And as someone who I now look up to, as someone who shaped the industry in terms of drafting and instruments of service, that class in high school must have had a really lasting impact on you.
Well, actually, by that time, I'd kind of decided, I don't know how, in about the third grade, that I wanted to be an architect.
Wow.
But I didn't know anything about technical drawing. But what I do to entertain myself was I would envision houses and I'd draw elevations of them.
Oh.
Not the, you know, the plans and stuff. But when the opportunity came up to take this class, actually in junior high and high school, when I was in school, you know, the girls had to take the home ec courses and the boys had to take like shop and mechanical drawing and stuff like that. But my high school had this one class in actually architectural drawing, and which I think was quite unusual. I don't know if any of the other schools in Seattle had that. So I said, yeah, that sounds interesting. So we learned a lot of stuff about, you know, like profiles, like of even like a water line or a sewer line, you know, if, you know, learning how to read those kinds of drawings, you know, civil engineering drawings, and how to calculate and draw them up, and
that is
using
impressive.
Different scales, and you know, it's just, I can't remember all the details of what they taught us, but it was quite interesting. I was probably more interested in it than most of the guys who were just looking for, oh, I've got to take another class.
Wow. So you graduate high school, and then you enroll in the University of Washington architecture program. So sounds like third grade you actually knew you wanted to be an architect. But
yes.
At that point, you must have been 100% invested.
Yeah. It was kind of funny, actually, because, you know, I had all this interest in it, but somehow my mother never thought I was serious. So when I actually enrolled in University of Washington School of Architecture, she said, "Oh, you were serious."
You're like, "I've been drafting and drawing this whole time."
Yeah, and then when my parents were remodeling the house, they didn't really have the money to pay the architect to draw everything up. So my dad did a lot of the drawings because was a trained engineer. And so even though he is a chemical engineer, he did learn a lot about drafting things. So he drew up, you know, the floor plans and sections and elevations of all this addition and stuff, kind of under the tutelage of the architect, I guess, so he could get a building permit. And then my sister and I were laborers. We'd like pre-stain and pre-paint boards that were going, you know, wow, for soffits and stuff like that. So
yeah, you were yeah, in it.
But once I got there, I just enrolled as a freshman and went straight through the 5-year Bachelor of Architecture program and came out the other end.
Right on. Well, a lot of us have tons of memories from architecture school. Do you have any that stick out to you?
Yeah. The school was kind of stretching its, you know, the capacity. There's an architecture building on the UW campus that dates actually from the 1909 Yukon Pacific Exposition. And that's where the school was located, but it didn't have enough classroom space. So they leased a old building that was about a block off campus, not far from the main architecture building. And it would had originally like a grocery store and little retail things on the first floor and then apartments on the upper two floors. So they turned it into design studios.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But all of these big high storefronts at the ground floor and stuff, they boarded them all in, I guess, to, you know, first of all, I think they were like folding doors and stuff like that. You know, if people had a market, they wanted to open things up to the sidewalk. So, you know, it was kind of all boarded up. And then one of the design studios was in that space. And one weekend, some of the guys in my class decided, I wonder what's under all that plywood. And they started prying off the plywood, and all the light is flooding out in the street, and a campus police car was going by and came to a screeching halt because, you know, there's not supposed to be all this light emanating from that building. And I think I kind of got in trouble, but in the end, they didn't put the plywood back up, but they secured all the doors and stuff, you know, so that the building was secure. But, you know, interesting things like that. And
wow.
When we were seniors, the tradition was that your class would take a class trip during spring break. And usually that was to some place like San Francisco or Chicago or whatever to look at buildings. My class went camping in the San Juan Islands.
Oh, so you're right at home with camping then.
It was a miserable rainy weekend, but, you know, kind of, it was late 60s, you know, all the kind of nonconformist type of kids who were in school at that time. So we just did things
fun.
Differently.
Yeah. So you graduate from University of Washington with a B-Arch.
Yeah.
And you eventually come to Hawaii.
Yes. In fact, the same month as graduation.
Wow.
Because I had felt for a long time that since I grew up in Seattle, I went to school in Seattle, that if I was ever going to kind of experience anything else, that I should, you know, probably move somewhere else after graduation and work somewhere. And early on, I thought maybe Colorado, because I like skiing. I did a lot of skiing in high school and college, so I thought, oh, maybe Colorado would be a good place. But then I met my future husband. He was in architecture school there. He came in junior year. He started out at Oklahoma State and he transferred to Washington. We studied together a lot. And then, so I says, well, why should I go to Colorado? So when,
it's a good excuse.
A couple weeks after we graduated, I moved to Honolulu.
Wow.
So my story is that I followed him home from school and I've been here ever since.
When you came here, what was it like? How was the profession doing? What was your impression?
The profession must have been doing fairly well, though I don't have an overall recollection of what it was like, because it was not difficult to get a job as a new graduate. But at that time, I don't know, we weren't particularly focused like the students are urged to focus now on, you know, planning for your future, really trying to, you know, determine kind of what it is you want to do and then going after it. You know, our goal was to graduate and get a job. Mm-hmm. End of story. So if you could graduate and get a job, okay, you were on the right path. So I had no idea what I actually wanted to do other than that I wanted to be an architect.
Gotcha.
So that was, so where was your first job? I actually, the first couple of weeks I worked for a really small firm that one of my classmates, a girl in our class, had worked at the summer before and she just loved it. So I got a job there, but it wasn't a good fit. I'm not sure exactly what it was, but the boss recognized that within about 2 weeks and essentially fired me.
Oh, no.
So I got a job at, the name of the firm at the time was Roerig, Onodera, and Kinder. And they were located on the top, kind of like a little add-on penthouse structure that was on top of the old First Hawaiian Bank on King and Bishop that was torn down when mm-hmm. the current mm-hmm. tower was built. So we were up there in this little funky warehouse edition, well, not warehouse, penthouse edition, and had our office there. And that firm, interestingly, was the successor firm of C.W. Dickey.
Oh,
so
okay.
In the drafting room, they had this big board with the names of all the employees who ever worked there. So names like, you know, Cy Lamon from Lamon, Freeth, Haynes, Jones, Farrell, which became Architects Hawaii, and, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of luminaries in Honolulu mm-hmm, architectural mm-hmm. history at one time or other worked in that firm, so we dutifully put our names yeah. on the board also. So I worked there for about 2.5 years, and then at that time, Kenji Onodera, who was the senior principal at that time, he had some severe health problems and couldn't continue working, and the other two partners didn't really seem to, you know, have a real vision of where the firm was going, and I couldn't really tell, so I figured that might be a good time for a transition to another job opportunity. So I got a job where I still am at today. At the time, the firm was Hogan & Chapman. So it's gone through a lot of name yeah. changes over the years. But
and were you doing any drafting at that time?
That's what one did when one got out mm-hmm. of school. And it was typical to kind of start on restrooms, drawing toilet room plans and elevation seemed to be a good technical exercise for new graduates to get your feet wet. So actually when I first worked at Roerig, Onodera, Kinder, they were doing renovation to the Princess Kaiulani across the street. Mm-hmm. So I worked on a lot of interior drawings for, you know, they were redoing the hotel offices, the front desk, the newer tower, which was built in the late 60s, was just under construction. So we worked with Sheraton Design Branch out of Boston or wherever they were on the East Coast with their design ideas to do up, you know, the technical drawings, permit drawings for, you know, like the ballroom, the function room, several restaurants, things like that. Wow. So that's kind of the first stuff I worked on. But the very first one was the restrooms.
The restrooms. And this was all hand drafting.
Oh yeah.
Back then.
Definitely.
I mean, I've heard of, you know, things like Mylar and pin bars. I mean, some of our listeners, they might not even have heard of these things or know of any of these tools that yeah. have evolved over the years. Could you talk a little bit about yeah. those tools?
Yes, and actually before that, when we were in school, everything was like pencil on paper or ink. But ink was, I don't know if you've ever heard of crow quill pens. They're mm-hmm. like kind of like a technical version of a fountain pen where you have to okay. dip the pen into okay. the ink. And if you can imagine how challenging that is to keep straight lines, keep them from getting thick and thin. Yeah. And so, you know, T-square, triangles, you know, compasses, whatever, you know, to do all your drafting. So it, when we were in school, the really big thing, and what, as soon as you could afford it, what you did was you got a, bought a parallel bar and rapidograph pens. I don't know if you've ever used rapidograph pens. They're technical pens that come in different width of point, and they have refill cartridges, so you didn't have to dip your pen in the inkwell to draw. So, and then, you know, you were really hot stuff when you had the money to buy an electric eraser. Because in those days, since everything was on paper, if there was a mistake, you actually had to erase the darn thing, unless you wanted to throw away the whole drawing and start over, which is not economical. And one of the reasons I think we switched to Mylar was because it would stand up to erasing a lot longer. You know, it was a lot sturdier, because sometimes if you erase too much, you can actually make a hole in your vellum drafting paper. So Mylar was a good improvement. So we went through ink on Mylar. And then when we got into systems drafting, we did a lot of cut and paste, where we'd stick on transparent, you know, like acetate copies of, like, doors with the swing or windows or things like that, and you could stick them on the drawings. So just like in the computer, you know, when you, if you flip the door over, you take off your double stick tape, put it on the other side, and put that door down on your drawing, and voila, you've got it swinging the other way. So we went through that and then into overlay drafting, which is where the pin bars came in, because you have Mylar is also very good and stable. It stays nice and flat. And the pin bar, I forget, it had a lot of pins in it. It was a stainless steel, real thin piece of stainless steel with brass pins. And then you'd have holes for those pins punched in the along the top edge of the Mylar. And so you'd put the Mylar over the pins. You'd make multiple layers, and you'd draw, usually with ink. Or we used, actually, chart tapes, custom width tapes with different patterns to represent, like, CMU, solid black for concrete, another pattern to represent a stud wall. So with a non-reprographic pencil, a blue pencil that the camera wouldn't pick up, you'd kind of rough out your layout, and then you just stick all the stuff down. And it was actually fairly fast once you got the hang of it. But the pin bar stuff was the forerunner to CAD, actually, because you were doing things in layers just like you do in CAD. So you'd have a layer for your title block. You'd have a layer for the grid layout of your building. You'd have a layer for the floor plan layout. You'd have another layer for the ceiling patterns. You'd have other layers for notes, and you kind of mix and match and interchange them to create the drawings you needed. And then you had to have a good registration system and tagging for which layers went together to make which drawings, because when you were ready to actually produce a set of drawings, then each layer was photographed onto a large format negative, and then they were photocomposited into all the layers for the sheet, and then offset printed. And so you could even get colors for different layers if you wanted to differentiate different disciplines or whatever. But what it meant is you really had to be complete with your drawings, because you can't go back and just make one change in this detail after you've offset printed 100 copies of your, you know, set of plans. So it was a whole different kind of thing. But then that went pretty directly after just a few years. It, you know, CAD became more accessible and robust enough that you could actually utilize it. And computers actually got to be fast enough, you know, to really accommodate that. Because when we first started doing stuff on computers, we were basically doing 3D images of things. And you'd set something up, and then you'd have to render it. And some of the rendering on those old slow PCs, you know, it would take like overnight. And then you come back in the morning to find out that your computer had crashed.
Oh, you know? That's the worst.
So those were not really user-friendly tools. But when AutoCAD came out, yeah, you could kind of work with that, you know, and, you know, use it as a real tool, yeah. Unlike some of those real, you know, kind of real schematic kinds of things. Mm-hmm. That.
How did you come so passionate about drafting?
Well, it's kind of what I learned to do. And then I always have been more technically oriented. And for all that my grandmother was an artist and all that, I'm not really that much of a designer, at least not conceptual. And art, I don't really do. I'm not free thinking enough, I guess, at all. Anything I try to paint or sketch looks very forced, so I don't find that satisfying at all.
I mean, I remember you telling me that you regularly use Revit.
Yeah, and every day. Yeah.
I mean, you've seen the process through hand drafting, through all those technologies, to CAD, like just to Revit. I mean, revolutionized the process at your own firm, actually, and then you were helping to share some of those revolutionary ideas, mm-hmm. with the greater profession, mm-hmm. is that right?
Yeah. Well, when a lot of these tools were being developed, there were a lot of seminars, workshops, particularly on the mainland, that you could go to learn about all this stuff. So I regularly went to them. And you'd share ideas with other participants from other parts of the country. And so after, you know, a while doing that, I was actually invited to be a presenter at some of those. And then some of the local professionals, architects and engineers, feared, why should we have to go to the mainland for that? Carol's here, we should get her to do a seminar. So actually, my boss, later my partner, Don Chapman, he got me started on the whole thing of, you know, developing systems drafting, but he wasn't that keen on sharing it with others. He says, you're going to tell a competition all our secrets, but actually, it's not that easy to do. You've got to spend time and know what you're using it for and develop it for your own firm. So you're not really sharing that much of a secret. You might be giving somebody an idea of what they might do with it. But one advantage of having certain techniques and stuff more widely used in the community is, you know, people move around from job to job. And if you're hiring, you know, why would you want to hire somebody and train them from scratch that didn't have any idea what the kind of going thing was in, you know, drawing technology, or work with consultants who were totally, you know, back in the pencil and paper era still, if you were into computers. So it made sense that everybody had at least a, you know, a common base of, mm-hmm. basic knowledge and understanding. It was good for all of us. Mm-hmm. So Don finally got over his concern about sharing things.
I mean, I think what we just talked about, it's obvious to me that you've had a lot of foresight. You've been an early adopter of change in the profession, a lot of times much before it becomes relevant. And I have to ask you, I talk to a lot of emerging professionals. A lot of them are not sure what kind of niche they want to focus on or if they should specialize in anything. You definitely found yours.
Yeah, by accident, actually.
I mean, any advice to those people?
Keep an open mind. Don't decide too early necessarily that this is my path, at least not to the exclusion of exploring other opportunities. Because it was very interesting one time, it wasn't my class, but it was a different class at School of Architecture, where the instructor invited several of us to, you know, come and speak to the students. And basically, it was more like just a question and answer, not us making presentations necessarily. But they asked us, like, well, when you're hiring somebody, you know, a student or somebody out of school, what do you look for? And they were shocked to hear that we didn't really care that much about their portfolio or their resume, we wanted somebody who had an open mind, was willing to experience things,
absolutely,
was good on following up on their mm-hmm. commitments, you know, those kinds of traits, because the more technical things, which are going to vary a fair amount from firm to firm, depending on what the firm's focus is, you can kind of teach those. But if you have people that say, you know, I don't want to do that, you know. And a lot of times, if your boss is asking you to try something out, like Don was with me in systems drafting, it's because they feel that you could do something with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not trying to punish you by giving you that
yeah.
assignment. You know,
yeah, they have the confidence
in you. Yeah, yeah. And so that's an interesting aspect that I think people don't necessarily think about, you mm-hmm. know. And my career just really developed because an opportunity came up and I got into it, and it led to something else, led to something else, led to something else. It wasn't anything at all that I planned to be. In fact, since I didn't have any particular plan or goal when I got out of school, you know. And not everybody can be what they think they might want to be. Because when I was teaching professional practice, one of the assignments I gave the students every semester was describe the kind of practice you would like to be in, what you want to do, just to see if they were thinking about anything. And probably 80% of them said, I want to be a designer. And I'll have a partner who will take care of all of this stuff.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know,
interesting.
The financing,
yeah.
the mm-hmm. getting the jobs, you know, human resources, all that. They just want to be the designer. But if you look percentage-wise at any class from any architecture school, probably not that many of them are destined to be the designer. You know, there's so many other roles
yep.
that you can actually box yourself in and not have the opportunity, give yourself the opportunity to find something that's really would suit you because you haven't been willing to give it a try.
That's good advice. And I guess speaking of, you know, these emerging professionals, I can't imagine how many future leaders you've probably impacted through your service, especially on the AIA. One of the common threads that I've seen woven into your life is mentorship. And we've got to know each other through the very first year of the AIA Honolulu 5x5x5 mentorship program. You were one of the mentors. What's the importance of mentorship to you?
Well, I think actually that's how any of us learns best. Because you can learn things by reading in a book or watching a YouTube video. But to have an interaction with someone who does that, knows that, has a passion for that, whatever that happens to be, is very powerful. And so it can be, you know, your teachers in school, your professors, it can be the principals in your firm or even other more senior staff members, mm-hmm. or one thing I'm a firm believer in, and I know you're on that path too, is getting involved professionally in your professional society,
yep.
making a contribution. You find mentors in yep. those kinds of relationships, and some of them may actually be your peers, but they're in a different setting, and you can learn so much from them, especially if you're going to things on the mainland and the friends you're making serving on national committees live in different cities, you can more freely share ideas and experiences and what your firms do because they're not your competitor
yeah, yeah.
from down the street.
That's so true.
So but I also firmly believe that you can't force a mentor on anybody. The person has to be willing and interested in that kind of interaction. It's kind of like, and I'm not sure exactly where this old saying comes from, you know, when the student is ready, the teacher appears.
That's a good one.
And so I think you don't have to wait around for somebody to appear. If there's somebody you want to learn something from, you can, you know, create a relationship.
Yeah.
And because, and one thing I think in our profession is architects are always willing to share with others coming up, you know, their experiences and, you know, how to avoid certain kinds of pitfalls, you know, because we all have the horror stories also from our projects. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there's just a lot of things you can learn from anybody. And an example of that actually is, it may seem kind of odd, but I learned how to calculate overhead rates and billing rates and stuff like that from Frank Haynes, who's principal of Architects Hawaii. Because he was doing some workshops for young architects to teach us stuff like that. So I learned, you know, how you do that from Frank.
Stuff.
Yeah, and then I had other interactions with Frank over the years. And he was the one actually who instituted and for many, many years taught the professional practice course at School of Architecture here. But when he was 65, he decided it was time to retire from that. So he told the dean, hire Carol, have her take over this class. So then I taught it for another like 15 years or so, I think, beyond that. But he was really free with sharing all his resources, his prep, his syllabus, all that kinds of thing. And then other AIA things I'd go to on the mainland, I'd get acquainted with people who were also teaching professional practice at their local architecture schools. And we'd trade ideas for good, you know, assignments for students to keep them engaged and stuff like that. So you never know where you're going to find a mentor. And you probably don't need just one. You need a whole bunch for different kinds of things because you have different things that would be worthwhile to learn.
Yep. And you just talked about professional practice teaching at the School of Architecture. You also were instrumental in the development of the Doctor of Architecture program and the practicum program. How rewarding has that been to be involved in that?
It's been very rewarding. I really enjoyed teaching professional practice. And then I was asked by Dean Ye, who was dean at the time, to participate in the various planning committees for, the Doctor of Architecture program. So we spent actually, I think, about 7 years.
Is that right?
Not intensively, maybe, but, you know, kicking around ideas, the value of it, how would it be structured, what's the value for the student for spending 2 more years in school, what's the value to the profession of the student having that much more, you know, educational background, because what any of us that went through five-year bachelor's programs or even a 4+2 bachelor's and a master's program will recognize is you've just begun to scratch the surface of a lot of topics, and some you may not have even gotten to at all. Architectural education could pretty much run on forever. So we were always very interested in practice education and how to make it more practical. And so we would go to mainland workshops and try to get things implemented in the curriculum so that, you know, you knew more than design theory and stuff like that. You could actually, you know, put it into practice in some meaningful way when you got out of school. So that led actually, in a large extent, to the practicum program that the school implemented. And so that took... That was another excellent example of mentorship, actually, because when that program was going strong, and I'm not sure how strong it still is, each student that was sent out to a firm, you had to get that firm's buy-in and the buy-in of senior leadership in the firm to actually guide the student and expose mm-hmm. them to mm-hmm. all the different aspects of their practice.
Yep.
That's mentorship big time.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And so it was interesting because I think one of your questions too is how, you know, that I actually went through the program myself.
Yeah, I was amazed to hear that not only did you help develop the program, but you went back to enroll in it.
Yes, well, I was kind of strong-armed in a way by Gordon Chiao, who was the associate dean. And by Joyce, they said, well, you've put all this time into it. And, you know, the first class actually was established professionals going back to
get this degree.
Okay. Yeah, because it took a while to get the more, you know, regular, normal architecture students to transition into that program. So the first year, it was all mostly licensed architects. You know, Francis Odo was one of them. Me, Mike Lineweber, even Elmer Botsai. You know, there's a lot of us. And even some from out of state that came, you know, to be part of that first class.
Legends in the profession.
Yeah. So one of the things we had to do, because this is not a PhD, not a research degree, is we had to have a doctoral project. So my project, actually, because I was interested in the topic anyway, was to develop the curriculum for the practicum studio. And, you know, the whole outline, all the evaluation tools, you know, the structure of the course and all that. So that was my doctoral project.
I don't know if you know this, but I was fortunate to be the instructor for that course a couple of years ago.
Oh, great.
It's been really fun to kind of follow in your footsteps in that sense and just see the impact on the students.
Yeah, I think it's been positive, because otherwise when you come out of school, because I know when I was teaching professional practice, the students I had were either mostly fifth year, you know, kind of just before graduation. And the first assignment I gave at the beginning of the semester was to do a resume. It helped me learn about the students, because since that's the only class I taught up there, I didn't know most of them ahead of time. And it's amazing how many in their last year of architecture school had never had even a part-time job in anything related to the profession. You know, they worked in restaurants, you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But very few of them had any contact at all with the profession.
Wow.
Or even with construction. Working for a contractor is a very good experience. It's one I had when I was in college, working for a big millwork contractor. So I really put those drafting skills to work at that time. And actually that, when I first got out of school, that experience and expertise opened more doors for me in job interviews than my degree did, because I had a practical skill that could be utilized right away. They didn't have to teach me everything. Because a lot of architecture graduates are really green. Mm-hmm. They think they've accomplished a lot, but they're really still at the beginning of the road, and they are going to be learning a lot in there as they go through their career.
Oh yeah, I mean, I've heard from one of my mentors that I think the first 20 years of practicing, you finally get to a point where you feel semi-competent, but we're always learning. We're always growing.
And we have to, because new materials, technologies keep coming up, the codes keep getting more complicated. Yeah. It's nothing where you can just kind of sit back and cruise, because it's always evolving very rapidly.
Yeah. Well, in this last section of our discussion, I do want to touch on your participation in the AIA. You served as a prominent leader in the AIA. You were the first female president of the Hawaii Society AIA. That's what it was called at the time. You also chaired AIA National's Women in Architecture Committee in 1987, and you chaired AIA National's International Markets and Practice Committee in 1995. At the time, I would imagine you're one of the only women architects from Hawaii to ever serve on an AIA National Committee.
I think that's probably true, but in AIA, I might have been the first. I was kind of tapped for Women in Architecture Committee membership. It wasn't even really on my radar, but Chris Smith, mm-hmm. CJS Group Architects, he was had been national secretary of the Institute. about that time. And so he and Jane Hastings from Seattle, I think they were the two that said, Carol, you need to do this. So I said, why not? And it was very interesting. And one of the committee members at that time, who I got to know quite well, was Susan Maxman, and she was the first woman president of AIA National. Mm-hmm. So we met and worked together on the Women in Architecture Committee.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So it was interesting, you know, to go. We had a lot of sessions at conventions, and female architects, you know, who were attending would come, and you'd hear about how the state of the profession was in their areas, whether they were suffering discrimination, having problem getting jobs, dealing with advancement. And one of the things that was a really big problem at that time, and we tried to make a little dent in it through, you know, awareness if nothing else, was we had this goal of 90 by 90, which was 90% of the pay that the males make by 1990. Because it was less than that, but they're still not actually pay equity all these years later. I think it's improved, but you know, there's still a ways to go.
Yep.
And I think women, there's just more women in the profession, which leads to more acceptance, more women having their own firms, more women being leaders and principals in the larger or any size firm, actually. Mm-hmm.
Well, I do have to ask you, looking ahead in 2024, I think that we're going to be having the 9th Women's Leadership Summit since 2009. We're also going to be welcoming 3 consecutive AIA presidents who are women for the first time in AIA's history. So how do you feel about the time that you've been on the Women in Architecture Committee and then the work that we still have left to do?
Yeah. Well, things, as I said, are really moving in a positive direction. I don't happen to know personally any of the 3 ladies who are, you know, the current and immediate past presidents of AIA. And then there's also a female executive of AIA as well.
Right.
I think she's the first one in that role. So,
Lakeisha.
Yeah. So it's things are definitely different, because when I first joined AIA as an associate member in the mid-70s, I think there were only like 250 female members of AIA in the whole country.
No way.
Yes.
Wow.
Well, of course, the profession was smaller then overall, but still, there just were not that many of us.
Oh, that is hard to believe.
So when we'd go to conferences and stuff and see other female architects, you know, it's kind of a big thing. Oh, you're one too. So I've made some interesting friends over the years, and you know, because of those kinds of ties that we would have when we would get together at conferences and things.
And I, you know, speaking of conferences, I was really surprised to hear that the AI National Convention was actually held here in Hawaii in 1982. And I can only imagine how exciting that must have been to be there, to be with all of your colleagues, and also the amount of planning that it would have took. What was that experience like?
It was kind of terrifying at times, actually. If you think planning a podcast is a lot of work, you know, the scale of it is just amazing. And we were selected as the venue, I think they regularly do like 3 years ahead of time. So somebody put together a proposal. They didn't decide to come to Honolulu. I'm sure someone from here had to make a proposal of why the convention should come here. So I was recruited to work on that, probably because I chaired the State Architects Convention about 3 years prior.
Oh, okay.
And so I had some
experience
with that. And so we would talk to people. We went to the 2 conventions before ours to see how they were run, see what the host chapters did, because host chapters were responsible for the host chapter party, tours. Usually they have a store on the convention floor where people can get, you know, kind of local souvenirs and
Do you remember
stuff
how
like
many
that
attendees were there?
It wasn't as much as you'd find in the mainland conventions because even though a lot of people wanted to come to Hawaii, they couldn't necessarily get their firms to pay.
Yeah, it's a big investment.
Yeah, well, plus since Hawaii is a tourist destination, you know, a lot of things don't happen here because the perception is you're only going to go there and play. And so that was kind of a setback for a while. But once we were given the slot, you know, we had to really get our act in gear. So we had a very active planning committee that met probably at least a couple times a month. We went to the two prior conventions. We actually set up booths, and we had coordinated aloha wear. We had big Hawaiian
print
banners.
Oh, on the conference floor, you had a booth?
Yeah, that we, you know, hung from the ceiling to kind of announce where our location was. And, you know, we were just, you know, really encouraging people to come here. And Ernie Hara, John's dad, he is a past master at all this stuff. And so anywhere he would go, he would take all kinds of flowers, anthuriums, orchids, all kinds of stuff. So our booth was very well decorated with, you know, not fake flowers, but the real thing. And he'd give them to people. And, you know, everybody knew Ernie because he was very prominent nationally in addition to
That's
here.
Amazing.
And, yeah. So we actually had a great time doing
I would think so.
The whole thing. We had an identity apparel line that we produced for the convention. We got Bruce Hopper, graphic designer, to design the fabric for us. It was all based on drawings of historic landmark architecture in Hawaii, different buildings like the Art Academy and so forth, anywhere where we could find really nice drawings, Alexander Baldwin Building, and they were reproduced in a print for the aloha shirts and mu'umu'u that we put together, sold.
Wow, that sounds so fun.
I was in charge of that committee too. That was a lot of fun. So, and we had a lot of local artists, a lot of whom were architects' wives, contribute things, you know, to stocking the shop that we had on the convention floor. And we just had a great time. It was interesting.
I do have to congratulate you as the 2023 recipient of the AIA Hawaii Medal of Honor. This is the highest honor for an architect in the state, and it certainly comes after many decades of service in the profession. Carol, you're so deserving of this recognition. I'm so happy for you. What does this mean for you?
Well, it's a great honor. And I'm thankful for it. It's one that was not expected at all because knowing about the careers and, you know, accomplishments of the prior recipients, I definitely am out of a totally different mold than any of them. So I was like, oh, somebody nominated me? Enough people nominated me that I'm a finalist? Wow. So that was kind of a revelation. It's definitely an honor.
Very well deserved. I mean, just talking with you and learning about you and everything that you've done, I'm just so happy for you. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
We'll end with a final question. And given your experience in the profession as a trailblazer, years of service, as the first to do so many things, what message do you have for emerging professionals and emerging architects today?
Basically, get out there and get involved. And hopefully you work in a firm setting that values that kind of, you know, participation, because it does take some time away from office hours if you're going to have any meaningful involvement in things. You know, be open, flexible, find opportunities to volunteer, because you're going to learn and grow in any of those instances. And you never know where it's going to lead to.
You never know.
What opportunity you might have that you never even dreamed of.
Thank you, Carol. On behalf of AIA Honolulu and the Emerging Professionals Committee, we would like to thank you for the opportunity to talk story with us today. See you in the next one. Ahui ho!